from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
I think the larger issue here is that you have a president that doesn't believe in intelligence, and that actually makes all of us less safe.
That's East Bay Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell on his concerns about President Trump's relationship to the nation's spy agencies. He'll join us in the studio to talk about his bill to set up a bipartisan commission to investigate Russian interference in the U.S. election and about the fallout from the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. It's all up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. East Bay Congressman Eric Swalwell has introduced a bill to set up a bipartisan commission to investigate Russian interference in the United States election. And as the top Democrat on the CIA subcommittee of the House Intelligence Committee, he is probing ties between the Trump administration and the Russian government in the wake of the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Swalwell is a former Alameda County prosecutor, and he joins us in studio this morning's first hour. In fact, we're going to have regular visits by congressional representatives, we hope, in the next few months, and talk about, as well, his work on behalf of millennials, his fight against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And welcome, Congressman Swalwell.
Thank you, Michael, for having me back.
Glad to have you back with us. And let's talk first about the idea of an independent, bipartisan, really public commission, which would take it out of the hands of Congress, like many Republicans say it should be in the hands of Congress. And this really not only comes out of your concern for the election in 2016. You're not trying to do a redo here or, you know, whatever. You're saying this should concern us about future elections, too.
That's right. This past presidential election, we were attacked. And the attack was electronic and nearly invisible, but it was by Russia. And they sought to undermine our democracy and influence it by a campaign with social media trolls using fake news dissemination and also hacking into the emails of Democratic Party officials and then disseminating that to help Donald Trump and to really denigrate Secretary Clinton. And I think the best way to understand how we were so vulnerable and most importantly to make sure it never happens again is to take it out of Congress and have an independent bipartisan appointed commission similar to what we did after September 11, that can look at what happened, make recommendations, and do it in a way that is depoliticized, that declassifies as much of the facts as possible, and also debunks so many of the myths that President Trump has put out there about our intelligence community.
And well, you got 17 organizations within the intelligence community who have said, yes, we were definitely hacked. It's incontrovertible. But you've also got a bill now. You've got House Bill 356, Protecting Our Democracy Act, which you want to move forward. The real problem, I know, for you has been getting or mustering up bipartisan support, and getting Republicans online. I know that Senator McCain and Senator Graham have talked as if this is of concern to them. But I think right now the only person you have on board is a North Carolina Republican.
That's right. And our goal here was, as you said, not to look backwards, not to relitigate the results. Donald Trump is the president, but to focus on the last finding in that public report from those 17 intelligence agencies, which is that Russia intends to do this again to the United States and our allies. And so one Republican has come on board so far, Walter Jones. He was actually the first Republican to speak out against the Iraq War. So he's someone, I think, who knows from time to time how to do the right thing. But we're seeking more Republicans. I've been speaking privately with a number of them, and I know they're worried at home. There's a lot of Trump supporters who have felt emboldened since the election, and a lot of Republicans are worried about doubling down against Trump because so many of them didn't support him during the campaign and now are fearful of what it would mean if they, you know, gotten bored with something that is seen as going after the president. And again,
they really are afraid, aren't they? I mean, Al Franken has spoken out on this, Senator Franken from Minnesota, and he said, you know, I know a lot of Republicans are very concerned about President Trump and concerned about where he's leading us, and yet at the same time, fearful about coming out and saying so.
Right. And what we're asking them to do is to put your country ahead of your party. And also, this is not seeking to undermine President Trump. This is seeking to say that this democracy is worth defending. And regardless of which party was the victim of the attack and which party benefited, this will probably happen again. And the constant should be that both parties say, we're not going to tolerate an outside meddler in our elections.
What about a new travel ban, a new executive order for a travel ban? That's coming up now. Where are you standing on that, or what are you trying to rally as far as that's concerned?
Yeah, so today's February 20, and it's 1 month into the Trump administration, and I would say it's been chaotic. That travel ban really, I think, not only would make us less safe because it targets a Muslim population and I think will inspire our enemy and also show our allies who are doing so much abroad to try and help us fight terrorism that we can't be a team player with refugees. And actually, I think most concerning, it makes us less us. It makes us less of a welcoming country and a country that's going to turn its back on the diversity that has shaped us over the last 240 years.
But you have a president who is condemning the judiciary, condemning the news media, also condemning intelligence services. And yet at the same time, you know, on the one hand, you hear it's a month and there's been all this chaos and very little in the way of light for many people who are opposed to the Trump presidency, were or are. Yet they have put out, the White House just put out a statement saying more has been accomplished in this first month by the Trump administration than any previous administration. I don't know if some would call that fake news, but I'm looking at talking about job creation. He signed a presidential memorandum ordering the U.S. to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, hosted the CEO of Intel to announce Intel's plans to invest $7 billion in factories that will create 10,000 jobs. After negotiations with Lockheed Martin, he saved Americans $700 million on a new batch of F-35 fighters. There's some bona fides here, aren't there?
Well, when I look at what's been accomplished, I see that you know, he's managed to alienate our allies. You know, he screamed at the Australian ambassador, threatened to send troops into Mexico. He has a jobs plan, but it looks like a jobs plan for billionaires in Betsy DeVos or Steve Mnuchin. But I haven't seen a jobs plan for anyone that I know who is looking for work. And also, this was supposed to be, you know, running government like a business and sending the great negotiator to the White House. And House Republicans are sitting there without anything to do because he doesn't have a plan for anything that he's promised. And then, of course, one of the most important roles in the White House sits vacant today in the National Security Advisor. And so I would say this has been a disastrous first month, and people are wondering, you know, when is he going to get serious and focus on the job at hand?
Well, he's doing some of what he promised to do, including trying to essentially repeal the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare. But I don't see anything, you know, coming in to replace it. Do you?
No, I don't see a plan. I see a tweet. And unfortunately, I had a town hall this weekend on the Affordable Care Act, and so many of my colleagues did here in the Bay Area. And what I heard from patients was anxiety and uncertainty because so many of them told me what the Affordable Care Act means for them. One person, Roy from Hayward, told me that because of the Affordable Care Act, he is able to continue working. He works on the docks in Oakland, and he's had a number of different injuries. And he said before the Affordable Care Act, it was going to cost six figures to address his injuries. But because of the Affordable Care Act, he's able to keep his back and his body repaired, and he can keep working. And he said if the Affordable Care Act was repealed, he'd probably have to move back to Texas and, as he said, mooch off the government, which he doesn't want to have to do.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Congressman Eric Swalwell, who is representative of California's 15th District in the East Bay, and who has certainly been doing a good deal himself since he took office. I just want to mention some bills on identity theft, actually enabling DNA technology in law enforcement and preventing Social Security fraud and theft. So kudos on that score, on those scores. But you've also championed the idea of doing something about student debt, and you're sort of a walking example of it. I mean, you've got a lot of student debt that you haven't paid off yet. What, about $100K?
That's right, Michael. And I went to college on a soccer scholarship, got injured, and my last 2 years of college, and then went on to law school and public college, public law school, came out with about $150,000 in student loan debt. And I've got about $100,000 today. My wife and I are expecting a baby. We're hoping to buy our first home in the Tri-Valley where I grew up. And we're finding that, just like so many people across the country, student loan debt is a barrier, and it keeps people in financial quicksand. And I'm gonna be fine. What I'm worried about, though, are people across the country who are starting families later, not able to buy a home and who are entrepreneurial but not able to go out and start a business because they're held back by student loan debt.
So let's talk about what can be done.
Yep.
I should mention, first of all, though, that you married a Republican Hoosier family, married into that, so there's bipartisanship within the Swalwell home now. What can be done? In effect, I know you want to rally the millennials and get them behind you the way Bernie did, or get them behind this whole cause and so forth. Where do you go to do that? How do you do that?
First, we can make college affordable and accessible. And what I mean by that is, if you are from a family that makes $150,000 or fewer, you should be able to go to a public university and come out debt-free. We've actually done that before in California during the 50s and the 60s. And the generation that benefited, the return on the investment from investing in them was that they built the great California economy, the tech sector in Silicon Valley, the biotech sector here in San Francisco, the aerospace sector in Los Angeles by that debt-free education. And then for people who have student loan debt, first, we believe the government should make no money on the interest, and the government has made $100 billion in just the last 10 years, that you should be able to double the interest you can deduct today on your student loans from $2,500 to $5,000, and there should be no income cap as there is right now at $68,000, making so many people in high-cost areas ineligible. And we also believe that if you have student loan debt and you're working in the public sector or you're working at a nonprofit, that you should get credit for that and see relief very early on so you can keep helping others.
You're kind of like Sisyphus, though. I mean, you're pushing against a Republican Congress, and a dominated Republican Congress that probably is very resistant to these ideas you just ticked off.
It's an on-your-own approach that the Republicans have for health care, that they have for access to college, that they have for anyone who loses a job and finds himself trying to compete in this new economy. And I think what we are trying to put out there as House Democrats is that we're all in this together. And the freedom of health care, the freedom to learn and have an education, and the freedom to work means that we all need to invest in each other. And when we do that, we lift everyone up, not just individuals.
We're talking with East Bay Congressman Eric Swalwell, who serves on the House Judiciary Committee and is the lead Democrat on the CIA subcommittee of the House Intelligence Committee. Did you see, by any chance, an article that appeared in the Sunday New York Times about back channels planned for Ukraine and Russia, courtesy of Trump associates? What they're saying essentially is, or they're reporting, is that several associates of President Trump, including his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, and a business associate, Felix Sattars, have been pushing a peace plan for Ukraine and Russia, and there are some financial ties.
I'm very concerned about President Trump's ties to Russia. I'm concerned that he doesn't understand the threat that Russia poses to Ukraine and what Russia has already done in the annexing of Crimea, the fighting that's taking place in Donetsk, the commercial airliner with 308 innocent souls aboard that was shot down by a Russian missile. And President Trump at his convention over the summer last year took out of the Republican platform a piece that said that the Republican Party believed that we should provide lethal aid to Ukraine to defend themselves. And so we're seeing a dramatic change in U.S. policy when it comes to standing with our ally Ukraine and making sure that we defend them against Russia. And frankly, Michael, I think the Obama administration could have done more to stand with Ukraine as well while Russia was doing this. But right now, I think we need to get to the bottom of what are the personal, political, and financial ties that Donald Trump has had with the Russian government before the election, and what paybacks are in place right now because of the help that he may have gotten.
Maybe the Democratic Party ought to hire a hacker like Putin did and get into his income tax.
You know, we don't play that way, and that's sometimes your strength is your greatest
facetious weakness.
But yeah,
you know, there was some activity off the New England coast. Russians suddenly firing stuff. In international waters, but nevertheless disturbing many people.
In the last week, we saw a Russian spy ship off the coast of Connecticut. A Russian fighter jet buzzed a U.S. Navy vessel, and we see continued fighting in Ukraine. And Donald Trump's answer as well, because he is being attacked at home about his ties to Russia, it's the media's fault and that Putin is just doing what he has to do. And so Donald Trump is Putin's apologist, essentially, and I think it makes us much less safe here at home.
You were part of the march.
Yes.
You joined
in Walnut Creek, the Women's March.
Locally in Walnut Creek and everything. You know, a lot of the goals that were talked about with that march had to do with pay equity and paid family leave and affordable health care and so forth. What comes out in your mind, other than people, you know, really feeling good and feeling esprit de corps and, you know, sense of solidarity. But I mean, as a congressman, what kind of action can come out of that kind of mobilization?
You know, Michael, before the march, the night before, I wasn't feeling so good. I was at Dulles Airport. I had just sat on the platform to watch Donald Trump inaugurated a month ago from today. And I was waiting for my plane.
You got some heat for that too, didn't you?
You know, I did, and I respect people who didn't go. And, you know, as a member of the House Democratic leadership team, I wanted to be there with my colleagues to show the president that we're going to hold him accountable, and also to thank President Obama as he departed. But I was sitting at the Dulles airport waiting for my plane, not feeling so great. And what really lifted me up was hundreds of women, armies of women who were getting off planes that had landed at Dulles, wearing those cool pink hats, marching toward the Women's March the next day. And so it just lifted me
up. It's uplifting, but can legislation come out of that uplift?
So I went to the Walnut Creek March the next day, and they were expecting a couple hundred, and it looked like it was about 8 to 10,000, maybe 8 to 10 million using the Donald Trump counting factors. But people are asking us now, all of us, what do we do next? And I don't think it's necessarily one solution for all of us. I actually think for some people, maybe you should consider running for office. For others, it's contacting members of Congress about the issues you care about. And I'll tell you, walking through my office in D.C., nothing gets my attention more than hearing those phones ring, 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 and seeing that my staff are, you know, off-footed because they're trying to answer the phones instead of being able to do what they have to do. Maybe it's volunteering with an organization. I helped out a group called Rise Against Hunger over the weekend, packaging meals for the hungry, and you were able to directly be involved with something that helped another person. So I think there's a lot of things we can do. We just have to make sure we direct that energy. And of course, as Dr. Martin Luther King says, and Nancy Pelosi tells us all the time, at the end of the day, it's the ballot box, the ballot box, the ballot box. We have to drive people to the ballot box.
Again, we're talking to Congressman Eric Swalwell, who represents the 15th District of California and serves on the House Judiciary Committee and is lead Democrat on the CIA subcommittee of the House Intelligence Committee. I'm going to open up our phone lines and invite you, our listeners, to join us with questions or comments that you might have for the congressman. And in fact, you can do that now. That is, join us by phone. The toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls, so feel free to join us with any questions or comments you might have. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Many ways we invite you to join the program. And I want to ask you before we start taking calls and emails and so forth about I saw the interview you did with Tucker Carlson. He really went after you, and I'm interested to know how you felt about that whole experience. But he started out by quoting Neil Gorsuch, who is the Supreme Court nominee from President Trump, saying all human life is valuable, and you both agreed on that. But then he said, again quoting Judge Gorsuch, the taking of human life by private persons is always wrong, and kept trying to get you to either agree or disagree with that statement. And you essentially offered counterarguments about a woman's right to choose and standard arguments, really, about a woman's right to choose. What he was really trying to pin you down with, I think, was, you know, is this life, is fetal life life, which is a difficult question morally probably for anybody to answer, particularly a politician or a congressman. But what would you walk away with from that whole experience? I mean, did you feel that you should have answered that question?
You know, Michael, when I was 20 years old, interning on Capitol Hill, I would go and watch Crossfire at the CNN studios at George Washington when the workday ended. And Tucker Carlson and Paul Begala and James Carville and Bob Novak were on Crossfire. And I always enjoyed watching them, you know, banter back and forth. And so I've been watching Tucker, you know, I guess for the last 17 years. And I think it's important for Democrats to not only go on MSNBC and CNN, but also to go on Fox. It's also the only place my parents will be able to watch me on TV. And so I was up for and still am up for answering his questions. And, you know, as to that question, you know, he was asking me something that is settled in the law and certainly up for debate as far as, you know, religiously and morally where people think it begins.
But that was what he was really asking you.
Yeah.
I mean, religious and moral question.
Yeah. And I'm telling him as the, you know, member of Congress for California's East Bay, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure it's always a woman's decision. And I'm not going to do anything to ever get between that. But we blew through the commercial break. It was a 16-minute interview, and you know, my friends and family were calling and saying, "Oh my gosh, he was talking over you the whole time. I hope you never go on there again." And I actually, I look forward to going back because I think it's important to, you know, defend your beliefs. And if I cost him a little bit of money because we went through the commercial break, then that's all right too.
Well, you certainly came off as your amicable self and all, but I remember Wesley Smith really hit you hard. He said you were stunningly callow in refusing to answer the question that Tucker Carlson put to you, which is, you know, sort of tough. You're a public figure. You're in the line of fire for that kind of stuff anyway, you know.
Yeah, I don't have any problems I didn't sign up for, so yeah, I can take it.
Well, here's Scott who tweets, if the GOP signs on to an independent investigation in the election, it will expose their party over country mentality. Not going to happen.
You know, it really is unfortunate, as I said, because if history has its way, we're probably going to see another attack. And it might not come from Russia. It could come from another country. And what I would hate to see is Republicans have put themselves in a position where they don't have any credibility on the issue the next time an attack comes. So I think the hard thing to do is to say, we understand that the Democrats were the victims. We understand that our candidate benefited and won, but both parties are going to come together and say that going forward, never again will we let this happen. I think that's what we both need to do. And, you know, Michael, if Hillary Clinton had won, I would still be calling for an independent commission to look at Russian interference, because I think it's that important that we were attacked. And we need to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Now, here's Karen who says, Mr. Swalwell is not my representative as I live in Oakland, but I want to thank him for his efforts to investigate the Russian hacks on the recent election. I entirely agree with his efforts to create an independent panel to investigate. But then here's Richard who writes, the hacks revealed serious misconduct in the Democratic Party. What makes Democrats worth voting for? I voted green for the first time in my life. I'll continue to vote third party until there is meaningful change.
You know, I've heard that argument too. Yeah. I've heard that so many people who were Cold War warriors and, you know, concerned about Russia for just the Cold War atrocities, who probably never would have imagined themselves defending Russia because their candidate won. I've seen them say, well, look what we learned from the hacks. And that includes Donald Trump, who said, look what we learned from the hacks. You know, as a prosecutor, we would call that fruit from the poisonous tree, meaning that you're using evidence that was collected in an unlawful manner, which I think you never want to present to folks because it just encourages more and more unlawfulness. But I think if your takeaway is that we learned interesting things about Hillary Clinton, then you're not appreciating that a foreign adversary meddled in our elections. And I'll also say, Michael, I went back and read the Federalist Papers to kind of get their thoughts on you know, the democracy that was evolving at the time, to see if they ever dealt with interference of an outside country. And they devoted a lot of time, Alexander Hamilton and others, to making sure that we protect our country from outside meddlers. We just defeated the British. We were helped by the French. And they wanted to go out of their way to make sure never was an American leader influenced by another country. And we got our sea legs, became a world power. But here we are again, you know, 240 years later, and we see another country seriously influenced our democracy.
When we return, we'll go to your phone calls. Again, we have Eric Swalwell, Congressman, 15th District, in studio with us, Democrat. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell, who represents California's 15th District in the East Bay here in Northern California, and we're discussing his legislative priorities, including reducing student loan debt and fighting the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Also talking to the congressman about his bill to set up a bipartisan commission to investigate Russian interference in the U.S. election and about the fallout from the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, which, as he said, has left a big vacancy that has yet to be filled. This is the first Inforum series featuring Bay Area members of Congress, and we are going to go right to your calls and remind you can join us by phone, toll-free at 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And our first caller is from New York. Susan, you're on.
Hello. I wanted to ask the congressman to comment, please, on the declassified report that came from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which found that the Russians had access and maintained access to several state electoral boards. It also did not assign a level of confidence to that assessment, which is not keeping with convention as to whether they had high confidence, low confidence, or moderate confidence in this. On Friday, Senator Claire McCaskill sent a letter to the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, which she is ranking member on, asking for the investigation to also include targeting of the election infrastructure. As we were told in the ODNI report, there was a conclusion that vote tallying systems weren't targeted, but there was no evidence given for that assertion. And as I said, there was no level of confidence given to that assertion. So I'm wondering if Congressman Swalwell can comment on this.
Thank you, Susan. The report did talk about what they described as the scanning of a number of state electoral systems, looking at the voter registration information, but did not find that any vote tallies were changed. But what I take away from that is that the Russians were showing us that they can do it, that they can mess with us, that they can have access. And just by gaining access, it creates doubt. Now, what I would like to see is for us to designate our election systems across the country as critical infrastructure. That would allow Homeland Security funds and resources to be devoted to making sure in future elections that they're working with each state and giving them the necessary information technology systems and advice and defenses that they're going to need. But I don't think any tallies were changed, but I think the fact that they did it showed that they could, and they wanted us to know that maybe they could go farther and change vote tallies in the future.
And Susan, we thank you for the call. They've obviously been involved in this sort of activity before outside of the United States in what used to be the Soviet Union, talking about probably elections in Ukraine, elections in Georgia and
Estonia. You know,
Estonia,
Georgian and Ukrainian members of parliament in my Washington, D.C. office this past Thursday, and they told me about the attacks that occurred in their country. And they also said, the world is looking to the United States to see what you're going to do, because you're the biggest country now that's been attacked by Russia. And we're all wondering, are you going to stand up for yourselves, or is this just the beginning of Russia taking down first world democracies? And it was really stirring to hear them say that, because they were victims too. And, you know, these, you know, leaders across the world who we don't interact with very often and, you know, may not have too much in common with to sit in the same room, and for both of our democracies to have been attacked, knowing that we do have a common enemy in Russia that is trying to reduce the role of, you know, free people and democracies across the globe. And now they have a new tool to do it, where they're looking at whether they're going to pay a price or if they're just going to, you know, have free reign to continue. And Germany and France are next.
That we haven't been involved in trying to influence in all kinds of ways, cyberly or otherwise, elections, because that's what, you know, certainly geopolitics is often about on the darker side of it. I just, you know, wondered what your response was, though, when it was brought up in an interview with Bill O'Reilly to President Trump that I'm not trying to talk about moral equivalency here, by the way, but we have obviously been involved in elections going all the way back to Iran, for example, and putting in the Shah, and, you know, so many other moves by the United States to interfere with what might be called democratic processes. But the reality is, when Bill O'Reilly talked about Putin being a thug and a murderer, you know, President Trump did make a moral equivalency. He said, well, you know, we've got our thugs and our murderers, too, and somehow to put us on a level with Putin.
That was jolting. I have gone in the last 2 years being on the Intelligence Committee across the world to visit our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. I've gone to visit the Marines who serve at our embassy in Moscow and South Korea. And I think it's demoralizing for them to hear that our own president thinks that we are on the same plane as Vladimir Putin, who, again, put aside the Cold War atrocities that the KGB committed. And look at just what they are doing in Syria and the slaughtering of innocent people in Aleppo that Russia has been a part of.
But you know, there is that argument that some people who feel that Trump is doing a reset on Russia will put forward, that it hasn't really worked before to say that Assad has to be removed, you know, which is what the Obama administration took essentially relentlessly in terms of. So what you could have with an alliance between Russia and the United States is not only a better fight against ISIS. This is the way the argument goes or the way it's framed. You know, you can have a better fight against ISIS. But you can also maybe bring about some kind of political resolution in Syria that the Obama administration could not bring about.
And I don't accept that because I do believe that Assad is a brutal dictator who has murdered thousands of innocent people. And also what is forgotten in that argument is that Assad is a magnet for ISIS, that his very presence continues to draw ISIS to Syria and allows them to recruit more and more people. And so it is an argument that is, I would say, multifaceted, but the best case scenario in Syria would be that we scrub ISIS from that area and we remove Assad and that they have a political solution there where they have a leader who is not just, you know, slaughtering as many, you know, Shiites as we have seen Assad do. And it's not easy. Nothing is easy in the Middle East. But keeping Assad in power will only allow ISIS, I think, to continue to recruit people across the globe to go to the battlefield.
Let me bring on more of our callers. We'll go next to Columbus, Ohio. Robert, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. I have a question which has always perplexed me. If every other modern industrial nation in the world has been able to formulate a healthcare plan for its population, I can't quite understand why we're not capable of doing that. Now, I know the counter argument that every other modern industrial nation who has a healthcare program, that program is actually failing and bankrupting the economies of their countries. But I just haven't seen any evidence of tens of thousands of people dying in the streets for lack of access to healthcare. And I haven't seen any evidence of any major modern industrial nation, let alone the second tier, failing and collapsing due to the strains from their the medical care system that they've put in place. So something doesn't add up that we could be the only one that cannot manage to do that or even borrow programs from the existing programs that work in the world.
No, Robert, thank you for the call. Let me go to Congressman Swalwell on this. Eric Swalwell?
I do believe people should have the freedom to be healthy, and that was extended through the Affordable Care Act. And the best healthcare system in America is one that covers the most amount of people, ideally everybody, that has the lowest amount of cost and provides the highest quality of care. Now, the only way to do that is you have to keep signing people up. The only way we can allow people with pre-existing conditions to not be denied coverage is to have a lot of volume, a number of people in the exchanges, in the system.
Well, the young people certainly didn't sign up. That was what went wrong.
Well, they're still signing up.
And the
5 million more.
Rolling out the program with cyber failures, shall we say.
Yeah. But 5 million more millennials, people my age, have health insurance than they did before the Affordable Care Act. But when you have people who are constantly trying to undermine the Affordable Care Act, as the Republicans have done, by trying to repeal it over 60 times in Congress, by governors who refuse to take the Medicaid expansion. By trying to undermine it, you make it harder for more and more people to sign up. And when you don't have enough people in the program, then the costs are going to go up for all of us. And so that's why I think, just to take a step back, if we all start to care a little bit more about whether our neighbor or the person across the street or people who live in our block have health care, that is the best way for us to bring down the costs for all of us. That's essentially what the Affordable Care Act does. And the Republicans want to go back to this on-your-own health care program where we're going to see costs go up 15 to 20% again every year.
Let me thank Robert for the call and go to more of your calls for Congressman Swalwell. Let me go to Menlo Park. Wynn, you're on.
Thank you. And Congressman, when I listen to your words, the first word that comes to mind is discipline. We have the Democratic and Republican leadership who keep their members in line with money, positions, and support for elections, and giving them health care and retirement packages that are way over the top. With the lack of representative support shows how difficult it is for Congress to get patriotic representatives to step forward and take individual action. Where's the hope that we as citizens should have that Congress is going to stand up and do something?
Well, we're standing right now, and if anyone was sleeping past the alarm clock on November 8th, I would say they're awake across the country right now, and people are expecting that we're going to have the freedom of healthcare and defend the Affordable Care Act, that we're going to do everything that we can to make sure that we have an economy that works for everyone.
Without a majority.
But, you know, the American people are with us. They are with us, and we're seeing that at town halls in the most conservative parts of this country. We saw in South Carolina this weekend. Last weekend we saw in very red parts
this
of Florida.
Demonstration today in Atlanta and a number of other cities.
And there's an open congressional seat in Atlanta for Tom Price's seat.
Right.
He's the Health and Human Services Secretary, and he won that district by, I think, 15 to 20 points, somewhere around there. And it's in play, meaning that a Democrat could win that seat because I think people are energized right now. And again,
of course, they thought Georgia was in play for Hillary Rodham Clinton, too, remember? I mean, I don't know. It gets into the whole question of the polls, too, which we don't necessarily have to go into because we go into the weeds there. But let me do this. Let me thank Wynn for his call and get another caller here. Will is next. Will, you're on.
Hey, how you doing? My name's Will, and I think I'm one of your constituents. I live in Oakland. I heard a question earlier, and I was really excited to hear an answer. You know, a lot of us Democrats are leaving the party because we're about to have another Democratic head who's another establishment guy. And, I mean, I think we learned our lesson with Hillary, didn't we? I'm not a Republican, but I'm leaving the Democratic Party because we're just not getting listened to. And I'd love to hear you respond to the real progressives out here that want to be Democrats, but we're just not getting recognized. And I'll take it off the air.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate
that. Thank you, Will. And Congresswoman Barbara Lee is your member of Congress, and she is a very independent member of Congress, too. I think you would like to hear. But, you know, right now we are going through the process of picking a new leader of the Democratic National Committee.
Looks like it's going to be Keith Ellison, doesn't it?
You know, I think it's too early to say. I think here we are blessed with a number of candidates. I think if there was a weakness that we had in the presidential primary field was we just didn't have enough people running. And I tend to think that more crowded primaries flush out weaknesses and your nominee is sharper when they go into the general election. So hopefully in 2020 we have more and more candidates. Now, Will, I will say I've gone to 32 cities across the country for this group I lead called Future Forum. We're trying to reach out and connect with millennials across the country. And what I've taken away is that millennials are a very progressive generation. However, they're very, very independent, stubbornly independent we are when it comes to politics. But Democrats, I think if we can inspire them to show up and that they believe that we're going to do everything we can to take the role of money out of politics, that we're going to stand up for clean air and clean water, and that we're going to make sure that our generation has good paying jobs in this new economy, I think they'll vote for us. They may not register as Democrats, but I think when they have to check the box, Democratic candidates will benefit. And we also, I think, just have to be more ourselves. And we saw Bernie connect with voters. Michael, I'll tell you, I went to Snapchat and asked the Snapchat folks down in LA, I said, which presidential candidate had the most popular Snapchat account? They said it was Bernie Sanders. I said, you're telling me that the oldest candidate in the race was the most popular one among young people? And they said, yeah, you know why? When he filmed his first snap, he said, hello, Snapshot. And they said, sir, it's called Snapchat. We can redo this. And he said, nope, one take. That's it. And they said that that was what young people liked, someone who was themselves.
They liked him because he was honest and he was himself. Yeah. You know, can you imagine if Bernie were chief executive now fighting these battles on Capitol Hill with a Republican majority? Let me go to some of these comments that are coming in. Joseph writes, the intelligence system is out of control. Perhaps Trump can overcome these pompous security agencies and reform them. Imagine an intelligence system that provides the equivalent of a presidential daily brief for the public. Yes, we need some secrecy, but not as much as many folks think.
I have not really been moved so far by the way that he's treated the intelligence agencies. Before he was even elected, he was saying that their findings on the Russian interference was political. And I can just tell you that overseeing the CIA on the Intelligence Committee for the Democratic side and meeting with so many of these intelligence officers across the world, they don't really care about politics. They really, really do not. They just follow the evidence. And so the biggest insult you can lob at them is to say that they're being political and to just throw out the findings of 17 intelligence agencies and say that that's just politics, you know, that really, really rubs them the wrong way. And so I don't think it's surprising at all. And I had said this about a month and a half ago that I thought the Intelligence Committee was going to have to be ready to receive a lot of whistleblowers because the steam has to come out of the pot somehow. And if the president doesn't believe intelligence is relevant and the president wants to undermine the work that they do, they're going to have to go somewhere to make sure that the truth is heard. And I think we're starting to see that now.
Question a little more close to home here. A listener wants to know, what could be done to prevent cuts to federal funding for Caltrain?
Yeah, we just learned over the weekend that it looks like the administration is trying to tie up some of the electrifying funds for Caltrain. And I'll credit Anna Eshoo, Jackie Speer, Zoe Lofgren in really leading this effort over the last few years. And so what we have to be prepared for is that President Trump is going to be vindictive and he's going to take it out on Californians. But this affects Republicans and independents and Democrats, not just Democrats. And so as we saw with the declaration when he declared a state of emergency for the flooding, it took a couple days, but it was because we got some of our Republican colleagues to also chime in on this, that we received aid. And so I think we're going to have to mobilize Republicans and Democrats to say, look, people want to spend less time on the train and more time with their family. And so don't be vindictive and hurt all of us.
Again, we're talking to Eric Swalwell, who is U.S. Congressman, 15th District, California. And Joey writes on Twitter, my parents are Republican too. Love them, but do you have any tips on how to get along better?
You know, Michael, I think the hardest thing to do is to step back and listen. And I told folks after the Women's March, we have to run for office. We have to volunteer. We have to make sure we're registered to vote. We have to call Congress about the issues we care about. And the fifth thing that we have to do, probably the hardest, is to listen to somebody that we don't agree with, especially about this most recent presidential campaign. I think just listening helps out. I have a Sunday night dinner with my parents, and it's very, very hard to take the heat that my mom and dad throw at me about the Democratic Party and what they believe in. But I've found that I can make better arguments to my colleagues and my constituents because I just take a step back and listen. So, Joey, hang in there. Keep listening.
And love may conquer partisanship.
Yes.
Here's Dave, who writes, can you please talk about the traditional composition and role of the National Security Council and its present fragmentation? In particular, can you address removal of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from the council?
I recently signed on to legislation from a freshman colleague of mine, Stephanie Murphy from Florida, who is calling to remove Steve Bannon from the National Security Council. Actually, what she is saying is that a political strategist, no matter who the president is, should not be on the National Security Council. And so what we have seen now is that the CIA director and the Joint Chief of Staff are not, in this administration, permanent members. They can attend the meetings, but it looks like the president is restructuring it and giving a larger amount of influence to his chief strategist, Steve Bannon. And again, I think that is a very, very slippery slope. Intelligence is meant to inform the president on the important national security decisions he has to make for all of us. And if it starts to get politicized, what we will see happen is exactly what he was accusing the prior administration of doing, which was using politics to shape national security decisions. And that makes all of us less safe.
Well, what are your thoughts about Bannon's pedigree and ties to alt-right? I mean, he was part of Breitbart, and certainly there was a lot of white supremacist activity going on in Breitbart.
Yeah. He has stoked the nationalist movement in this country. I think it's dangerous to have him so close to the Oval Office. Certainly the president is allowed to pick his team, but once he starts to let those individuals affect our national security decisions, that really worries me. And he has very, very extreme views about the United States' role in the world, which seems to be summed up as we can do it all on our own and put our country ahead of everyone else. And that just defies, I think, every serious moment in history, which is that we have come out of conflict because we were able to work well with other countries, and we have been buried in conflict, whether it's Vietnam or Iraq, when we went at it on our own.
There's a question from Bob who says, tomorrow night I'm going to a town hall meeting with my Republican Congressman Tom McClintock in Mariposa. What would be a question you would like to ask him if you were a private citizen?
great, Bob. Well, one, I hope you ask him to join our Protecting Our Democracy Act, which was alluded to earlier. Every Democrat is on it, and one Republican now, to have an independent bipartisan commission look at what Russia did in our election. But also, I think, you know, you're probably concerned, Bob, about your health care, and you should ask, what is the plan if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, to make sure that you have health care that's affordable and of the highest quality possible? I think, you know, that affects all of us. Also, Michael, I've seen now more than ever that the finances of a family are affecting everyone in the family tree. So right now, more than ever before, I think, in America's history, if the parents lose their health care, the kids are affected. If the grandparents lose their health care, their kids and their grandkids are affected. We're seeing this with student debt. We're seeing it with health care. So many of these issues are family matters because finances are so interconnected now among generations. And so this has a devastating effect up and down the tree.
And here's Alex. Alex, join us. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. While I do appreciate the congressman's comment imploring us to get to the ballot box, I think the story that's really the big one in this election that's not getting reported enough is the voter suppression. While we saw a glaring example in North Carolina, many of these Republican-controlled swing and firewall states saw Kris Kobach's cross-check purging legitimate voters from the rolls. For the first time since Ohio in 2004 and Florida in 2000, we saw the exit polls not line up. Many people likely voted but then had their provisional ballots, thanks to cross-check, being thrown out. I think more than Comey or Putin, it could very well have been what cost this election, especially since any kind of early voting that wouldn't have been accounted for in the exit polls would likely have gone to Hillary because it would have all been pre-Comey letter.
Now, Alex, thank you for that. I'm actually looking at our website, and Norma says, what do you plan to do about voter suppression? Yeah. So we're right in the heart of it here.
A lot of problems right now at the ballot box, Alex, and you're right to identify them. Of course, being at the Supreme Court a few years back throughout the many key parts of the Voting Rights Act. And so this is an important question that I think Judge Gorsuch should face in his confirmation hearings, is how does he view the voting rights that protect people at the ballot box? And will this Congress pass an updated Voting Rights Act to ensure that everyone has access? Also, the president is going out of his way to suppress voters, too. When he makes these outrageous claims that 3 to 5 million, as he calls it, illegal immigrants are voting, it's not just because it's his own ego that he's trying to protect to suggest that he won the popular vote. He's also trying to make people more afraid in the next election that if they show up at the ballot box because of what they look like or where they're from, that they may be challenged. And that is, you know, a very, very ugly thing to do, but it is a reality of this presidency.
Michael writes, why won't the Democratic Party push for single-payer health care reform, not health insurance? Welfare is what will motivate voters to support the Democratic Party.
Right now, our highest priority has to be to defend the Affordable Care Act. We put in place a health care act that expanded coverage to the most amount of people ever in American history, that seeks to continue to bring down the costs from where we were before the Affordable Care Act and wants people to have the highest quality possible. So we have to defend that. Now, if the Republicans repeal the Affordable Care Act and take us back to an on-your-own health care plan, then I think we need to be open to all ideas that, again, provide the most coverage, costs the least amount of money possible, and is of the highest quality. But right now, I think we did the hard work a few years ago by passing the Affordable Care Act, and we must protect our care.
Let's try to get Attar on here from Sacramento. Attar, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. My comment and for Eric Swalwell is, number one, it took almost 43 years to change the property law under the Alien Act, and it took almost 46 years to get the citizenship right in 1949. And out of that, we had the first Indian U.S. congressman in 56, 58, 60 out of Riverside County, Judge D.S. Sond. And the Heritage History Association, Washington, D.C., made a documentary on It's a reading material for the middle school, high school, and I would like the congressman to recommend it to the whole country that what Judge D.S. Sond did in his time in the Congress, and his autobiography is also available on the internet, the first U.S. congressman from India. And I don't want the Republicans to make some kind of law that we lost our freedom, and we have some kind of law that would, it will take 50 years to change it.
All right, Attar, let me come in here and go to Representative Swalwell.
Thank you.
You know about this, Congressman?
Thank you, Attar. No, I believe we're seeing a more and more diverse Congress. Our House caucus is Democrats. We are a majority and minority caucus, meaning that the majority of our members are diverse ethnically, by gender, and by sexual orientation. And so I think that's a good thing. And in the Bay Area and Northern California, Attar, I think you'll be happy to know that we have two terrific Indian American representatives in Ro Khanna and Ami Barrett.
But no Republicans.
No Republicans.
Some will say diversity, depending on how you call it. Thank you so much for joining us. Let me clear my throat again. Eric Swalwell, U.S. Congressman, 15th District, California.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Jeremy Siegel. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett, engagement producer Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for listening. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of the Minetti Schrem Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.